is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
I'm probably wrong. I am wrong on a hell of a lot of things.
And Adam Nathan.
And I think if that's the philosophy you have going into every game, more often than not, if you score more points, you'll win.
Go Hawks.
Another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one only unofficial UK Seahawkers podcast. Myself, Stuart Court, this week is, as ever, joined by the newly settled in at his brand new home every other weekend, Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
We're good. I think you might suggest that I'm not on my sharpest because I've just put a different set of headphones in to do the podcast with, and I was getting frustrated at how loud you were sounding more than my other ones, and I forgot you could just turn the volume down. So I've done that now, but it maybe suggests that I'm not in my finest form, but let's see how we go.
It's a strong start. Anyway, it's usually me who does the faux pas or early doors. So this week, with the draft, 2019 NFL draft, 2 weeks away, we're joined by a new guest and someone who has an amazing resource pinned to the top of the Twitter page. Alistair Corp, how are we, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad.
Yeah, can't complain. Spurs are winning again, therefore life is good. And Seahawk football's around the corner.
It is. They're back in the building pretty soon. So before we get into all the draft work you put in every year at this point, I just want to introduce yourself to people who may not have come across you on Twitter and social media, and also your work to do up on Field Goals as well, Alistair.
Yeah, I'm part of the writing and editing staff at Field Goals, and just kind of dive heavily into the draft every year. That's kind of the big part of the year for me. And I'm happy to be on today.
Are you a Seattle native?
No, I'm actually from just not too far from Vancouver in British Columbia.
Okay.
Also, there's going to be a lot of boots coming on this podcast, then, yeah. I spent 6 months in Alberta, and I absolutely love hearing the Canadian accent on anyone who has it on my TV screen. Anyway, that's a bit of a dive. So, obviously, the NFL draft is just 2 weeks away. As part of your work, it's a pretty invaluable resource, especially when the weekend hits and it gets to the third day and 90% of Seahawks fans haven't heard of the player from some small school in the middle of Oklahoma, because Alistair, Adam still doesn't believe the school that David Moore came from. So where did the idea come from to chronicle and profile and keep tabs on all the players which the Seahawks could end up drafting?
You know, a big part of it was kind of, it was born last year, just thinking about, you kind of knew they were going to go heavy after a running back, and for a long time, running back's kind of been the position that's drawn me in. It's what made me fall in love with the sport. It's the position I like evaluating the most, and so I just kind of did a deep dive into, like, okay, what are these running backs that they've drafted previously? Who are the guys they've targeted? What do they look like? And I kind of found that there's this consistent pattern of running backs who are between 5'10 and 6'1, 215 to 230 pounds. They jumped a certain thing in the broad jump. They jumped a certain thing in the vertical. And from there, I was like, okay, well, they have the prototype there. They have a prototype at cornerback. Let's see how far this extends. And then you kind of get to thinking, like, it's pretty much all the way across the board that they have these thresholds that they look for. And it helps to narrow everything down because, I mean, there's so many prospects available in a given draft, but you hear John Schneider talk about their draft board getting under around 150 players, and that's exactly how they narrow it down, and so that's kind of what I'm trying to replicate here.
Yeah, it seems and sounds like a hell of a lot of work, though, because obviously, especially some of the smaller school guys, their information is not as readily as available as the top 50-100 players on the draft and all the headline makers, especially in the build-up. Is it an extensive undertaking?
You know, it's a lot of emailing, like SIDs and communications directors at schools, just saying, hey, can you help me out with some protein numbers here? Reaching out to other beat writers have been a fantastic resource. You know, you hear Tony Pauline does such a great job kind of recapping pro days, and if I see that, oh, the Seahawks were at, you know, say South Carolina's pro day, I send out an email to a couple beat writers and a couple SIDs and just see, you know, what information can I get my hands on? Who exactly are they talking to? You know, there's a cornerback who's kind of rocketing up the boards right now named JoJuan Williams from Vanderbilt, and his head coach was actually Richard Sherman's position coach at Stanford. Oh. And after Vandy's pro day, I had reached out to one of their writers who I actually got to talking to last year when the Seahawks signed Caleb Scott as a UDFA, and he was like, yeah, the coach pretty much all along is compared to Richard Sherman. You know, here's all the things that they think is in common. So I pulled up his testing numbers and they're almost like exact clones. And so it's just, you know, those guys are around the team every day and they're just such a tremendous resource. So I really lean on them. They deserve a lot of the credit.
Well, JoJuan Williams is one of my favorite players, but he kind of seemed to slip a little bit on the back of his combine. And is his star back on the rise then after his pro day a bit?
Yeah, you know what? I can't remember exactly who it was. I think it might have been Tom Pelissero, but somebody yesterday mentioned him as a potential round one pick, which stunned me. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that much, but you know, if there's still teams that are trying to replicate kind of the long physical corners thing, and he is very much in that mold.
So yeah. as a rough guide, I always find the kind of 4 months between the end of the season and the draft a little bit silly at times, and you know, you end the season thinking that X, Y, and Z are going to be players 1, 2, 3 in the draft, and it becomes completely A, B, and C that turn it all around in these kind of third of the year silly season. How much does your work change from the end of the season to the draft? You know, how many more you know, bits of information and size can you find out, and you know, how many players does that add or knock off your list generally, or has it done this year in the last few months?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's two big changes that usually happen. It's kind of right before the All-Star games happen with the Shrine Game and the Senior Bowl that I start to really dive in and see guys who I think are particularly Seahawks, and I kind of make note of them, but then we never really have their testing numbers. And so the second change happens during the combine, during the pro days, where guys are falling off, or, you know, if a guy tests really poorly at the combine and doesn't seem Seahawks, and then he turns around at the pro day and puts up great numbers. So, like, the thing is teams are looking for a reason to draft guys they like. So if there's a certain prospect who I think is particularly Seahawks, but he doesn't post a certain number at the combine, but then he turns around and does, then that's enough for me to say, okay, I think that probably checks the box for Seattle. And so it just checks the box for me. So it takes, you know, it definitely develops over time. I'm probably going to do one last big update coming up in the next week, but now that the pro days are in the past, it's kind of settled and it's around about that 150 prospect number.
Yeah, obviously you mentioned the running backs are a pretty defined outline. Did Rashad Penny fall under all of those measurements? Did he come in all green on your sheet last year?
The only thing that he was short on, if I remember correctly, was the vertical, which I think he was a few inches short of the 35-inch threshold, but they have dropped below that a couple of times. I think they did it for Alex Collins and then maybe one other running back, but he was... he cleared everything else, and the big one for them is the size. I mean, they're just looking for a guy that's kind of the 5'10", 6'1", and 215, 230 pound with some explosiveness.
Yeah. Adam, go
ahead. When you're doing stuff like this, you know, obviously you will have your own views on the sport, as we all do. How hard is it to separate the Seahawks-y stuff versus the Alistair-y stuff that you'd like to see? And, you know, do you find yourself sometimes thinking, well, there goes that guy who's definitely not going to be drafted because of this reason, but damn, it's a shame that the team don't like, you know, him for this particular reason?
Yeah, I mean, I try to kind of keep it through a Seahawks lens so that I don't get attached to guys like that, but it's inevitable. I mean, you're watching so many guys part of the draft that people kind of pop out at you as just a player that you fall in love with. And sometimes, you know, not great. I still just kind of get attached to guys and get attached to the idea that this is somebody they could love. I mean, if anybody was following me on Twitter last year, I was just completely smitten by Tulane's D-end Ade Aruna. And his testing just screamed not Seahawks-y. His change of direction and agility was poor, but his explosiveness was fantastic. He was such a high character player that I just kind of clung to him as this day three edge rusher. And as a result, I kind of completely missed the boat on Jacob Martin. So that was a learning opportunity for me. But it is definitely something that I have to try to like actively do, keep looking through the Seahawks lens rather than my own personal bias.
So you've laid out the specs that the team look for running back. What are the specs they look for wide receiver, which as the draft edges closer, appears to be a position that they could dive in on earlier than most of us expected when the Dallas game ended?
Yeah, so I mean, I try to, wide receiver is an interesting one because I very much subscribe to the theory that it's kind of several different positions within a position. You know, you have like your big X receivers who went on the outside. You have guys that are kind of strictly there to take the top off the defense. You have guys who win underneath and in the slot. But there are kind of a couple consistent themes, which are just functional explosiveness. So it's kind of like a broad jump bigger than 10 feet, a vertical above 35 inches. And then you're looking for, again, just more functional speed than anything else. So it's kind of like a sub 4.5 40. And then the big one is a three cone, anything sub 7.2, you're kind of checking that box. But the height and weight requirements kind of vary because of the different roles. But if, as long as it's player that who kind of checks those explosiveness box, that's the big one, is they're just, even in places, you know, wide receiver is one of the more loosely defined ones by their thresholds, but they still do target guys who are impressive athletes, have, you know, great body types, and who they think they can kind of fit that role that they're looking for.
Is that existing depth something you take into like consideration when you're putting up, when you're putting your board together?
It definitely it's something that I try to focus more on. Like last year, I made a concerted effort to watch every single running back who fit that mold because I just, you know, it was kind of a foregone conclusion that it was something you're going to target. And this year, I'm very much focused on the guys who went on the outside more than anything else because I think they are okay with slot receivers. Maybe that changes if Doug Baldwin's status changes. But for the most part, I think they're still looking for that kind of X receiver, particularly if they're not overly confident in David Moore's ability to start 16 games.
Yeah. Well, it's that kind of do everything wide receiver is the one that they're probably going to try and target because it seems what they have already in Doug and Tyler. Adam?
Yeah, I mean, is it generally the offensive side that you find easier to focus on, or is there a position that, you know, is more difficult than others, that even if it's not just grouping into a Seahawks range, or is there just a position that is just much harder to analyze based on just general metrics?
Yeah, I mean, speaking kind of from a personal standpoint, the position that I have the hardest time evaluating is kind of anything along the O-line. You know, you can kind of evaluate how a player gets into their set and how they can land their punch, but there are still some things that slip through the cracks, and then that's kind of gotten a little bit more difficult in the last 2 years because it was the same thing when Tom Cable was around. They had very, very clearly defined thresholds at both tackle and inside. And now that Solari's there, it gets a little bit more difficult. But yeah, for the most part, it's definitely kind of along the O-line that proves to be the most difficult.
Is that because it's harder to spot a good player than a goddamn awful player that was the previous metric that we needed to pick up for an offensive lineman?
Exactly, yeah. Now I actually have to scout like offensive lineman rather than a defensive tackle from Div 2.
Ah, right, that makes sense, yeah.
So the few years ago, Spark was a big thing for Seahawks, and it seemed to be also Dan Quinn's mantra when he went over to Atlanta. It still appears to be that way. So how does all that, does that, is that still something you think the team look for, and how does that align with the work or the work you put together?
Yeah, I think it definitely is something that should be taken into consideration. You know, composite scores are tremendously valuable, and that's almost like the next step from what I'm doing. You know, I'm kind of collecting their entire athletic profile, and then the Spark score shows you, you know, so I'll look at a player and think, wow, this person has like a 98th percentile short shuttle and they're a defensive end. So that's going to scream out loud to the Seahawks. That's going to grab their attention. Then you look at Spark and you think, wow, across the board, they're a 98th percentile athlete. Then you think that even the next step of like, this is a player that Pete Carroll is just in love with. So it's kind of, that's why I'm fascinated with athletic profiles, because you can watch a player all you want, but if you don't have that athletic testing that kind of affirms or proves you wrong on something, then it's all, you know, it's only part of the picture. You're trying to put it all together, and Spark is very much a part of that.
Yeah, and is there a metric which suggests, like, that, especially along your line, whether a player could be someone who plays inside and outside? Is there something that we could, as you know, very little, Is there a metric or a measurement or whatever explosiveness metric that we could pin down as someone who could play both inside and outside?
Yeah, actually, I can't remember the exact number, but Josh Norris of Roto Worlds did this fantastic thing earlier in the year where he just pretty much showed every single offensive lineman in this decade who has had a short shuttle of 4.4 seconds or shorter or quicker, sorry. And pretty much every single one has gone on to start the majority of the games, whether they were a top five pick or a round seven pick. So that seems to be a big one. If you have that short shuttle below 4.4, then you are a player who should start pretty immediately and give your team tremendous value, regardless of where you're drafted.
Oh, wow.
On a more general level, the amount of work that goes into a draft is insane. I mean, you're presumably not doing this for an awful lot of kind of financial gain. If anything, you're kind of just doing it for the love of it and to write some amazing articles and whatever. And then there's people right up to general managers that are doing work, and there's still like maybe a 50% hit rate on a lot of these players. How much of this stuff is just, and I'm not talking your stuff, but how much of what teams look at is just nonsense? And how hard is it to separate what you think really does matter from what teams are still kind of tied to, that's hindering decisions and just making teams pick players that are clearly not suitable?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there's just so many layers that go into it that even a team, maybe less so recently, but in their heyday, a team like the Seahawks that were so good at drafting and so good at finding those gems, there's still those misses because it comes down to so many things. Like, you need to have the athletic testing. To some degree, you need to have the pedigree of the college success to even get the opportunity. You need to have the character. You need to go into the right situation. That's, I think, you know, you can talk about a player's athletic testing or their pedigree coming out of college all you want, but the biggest thing for me is you've got to get into the right situation. Jared Goff was on his way to being one of the worst draft busts in NFL history, and then he turns around and now he's in an amazing opportunity, and he's probably going to get $140, $150 million contract extension next summer because
please
his opportunity
God.
Changed.
We could but, get, yeah, I mean, get, there's, pray for that. Pray for that. We'll be saved.
But yeah, there's just so much that goes into that that I think pretty glaring misses are just a part of that business, unfortunately.
So one of the weaker positions, from what I've the little I've managed to watch from people players I've watched, seems to be the linebacker position, which the team seems. I think you wrote earlier today that it seems to be something the team have noticed as well. Is the wide held thought of the linebacker position being a bit weak after the first three or four names? Is that something you agree with, and something that definitely the team has been proactive with by re-signing Kendricks and KJ?
Yeah, it was something I wrote earlier today just about how that probably did impact their decision to bring right back. Because just looking at now, I have 12 linebackers on the draft board that kind of fit into Seattle's mold, but not a single one hits all of their thresholds. They all kind of have shortcomings in one way or another. And linebacker is actually kind of one of the positions that they've more strictly held to. And so I do think that is something that kind of went into consideration. I mean, there are a couple really interesting names listed there, like Blake Cashman from Minnesota, I think is really intriguing. I'm a big fan of Bobby Okereke from Stanford, and Ty Summers is someone who's been connected to the Seahawks by Tony Pollin. But they all have, like, they're good players, and they probably will come in and start. But they do have those shortcomings where I think it is a thing that, you know, the Seahawks had to ask themselves, do we want to just run it back with KJ Wright, who we know is going to give us, you know, we know exactly what he's going to bring to the table, or do we want to roll the dice on a guy who we are doing so knowing that he doesn't exactly fit what we want in the position? And so I think that did impact their decision to bring him back.
And also, as you know, on your document, KJ Wright is one of those rare examples at linebacker where they've kind of gone against the grain and gone outside of their thresholds and drafted the player who's been obviously a massive success. So it could be a similar case this year, and if they do go for a linebacker in the draft.
Absolutely. That's actually a big reason that I kind of latched onto Okereke early on in the process, just because he has a similar body type to KJ Wright. Like, KJ Wright's arms are something, I think they're the 98th percentile for linebackers, and Okereke is the same, like 97th percentile. He's just got a phenomenal range, and so he did kind of strike me as a player that, if the length is what made the Seahawks fall in love with KJ Wright in the first place and kind of overlook his athletic shortcomings, maybe it's a similar thing. So there definitely is a chance for that. But I think it's, you know, part of the picture that they had to take into consideration when planning for next year.
So I've also, for the back and defensive side of the position, which seems to be as often in mock drafts, which don't include trade backs, seems to be the position where most observers think the Seahawks are going to attack first, the safety position. And all the players listed on your sheet, bar two, hit every single metric. I mean, this seems like a pretty good year for the Seahawks, who have a perceived need at position, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, except for it's kind of an interesting thing. I'm still not totally sure if I'm in the minority on this or not, that I don't think last year told us the direction the defense is going to go, in terms of they changed their scheme up quite a bit. They didn't go single high as much, and I don't think that's really the direction they want to stay. I think that was more, kind of out of necessity. And so it is a deep safety draft, and there are a lot of really intriguing targets, but I still have my doubts that any of them are that proper center fielder like Earl Thomas was. You know, I think Nazir Adderley, maybe. I'm still not completely sold on that. Taylor Rapp, his 40 is very, very uninspiring. And then beyond that, like, you're betting on a guy like Juan Thornhill, who people have made the obvious comparison to Byron Jones, and Byron Jones, by most accounts, kind of failed as a free safety and got moved to corner, where he's excelling, but he wasn't able to do that center fielding job. And so there are a lot of really intriguing safeties, but there may not be any intriguing safeties for Seattle's need.
Yeah.
How much do you look at this? Funny you mentioned Taylor Rapp, because I was just thinking about the last time a Husky really has come out of college and performed in the NFL as well as a lot would have expected him to. And I can't actually think of anyone, if you think of the last 10 or 11 players that were linked, you know, thought to be potential first, second rounders. None of them have really lit the NFL up at all. At what point do you look at kind of the school or even the division that these guys are playing in and think, maybe that's a black mark against them?
Yeah, I think it has to be pretty extreme for me to get there, just because I try to kind of just not necessarily evaluate the player in the vacuum, but give him like a fair chance at everything. Mm-hmm. I think there's the really obvious one earlier this year when Stephen A. Smith was knocking Dwayne Haskins for being a runner, and the guy's not a runner at all. He's very much a pocket passer, but I think he looks at like Braxton Miller and JT Barrett, and you kind of get caught up in that. And so it's a dangerous game to play where you're worried about that. But you do have to take into consideration what program they're coming from. Like, if you're coming from a place that just kind of spits out pros, but it's just a heralded program that brings in the guys that are five-star athletes or five-star recruits, and maybe they don't develop, but teams are still attached to the idea that they have this pedigree. I mean, you could be a first-round pick and you could wash out, but you're going to get jobs for the next decade because of potential. I mean, the Seahawks brought in Taylor Mays for a visit. That's kind of the shining example. So you do have to kind of keep that in mind. But I don't necessarily knock Rapp for coming from a team that's sent us a couple secondary players in the NFL that maybe necessarily haven't performed up to their expectations.
I've been thinking a lot about the first pick, and obviously the common logic is, well, we'll trade down and see what's going on. I'm not necessarily entirely sold on that idea. I kind of think maybe if you can take the opportunity to get a good player in, I'm almost at the point where I'm wondering about the value of picks these days when you look at how a lot of the better teams are building themselves on getting rid of some picks and bringing in veterans, which seems like quite a new thing in the NFL. But it seems to be working for quite a few teams. Are there any players that like are Derwin Jamesy, in your opinion, that the Seahawks might think, well, if he's that good at 21, we wouldn't trade down the pick and we'd take the player? Or is it just a case of that pick's going and there's very, very little chance that anyone's going to be worth it at that position in the draft?
Yeah, I hesitate to say that anything would stop them from trading down, just because, I mean, we saw it, I guess it would have been 4 years ago now, when they passed on Miles Jack, which hurt quite a bit. And then again, even last year, looking at it, thinking, okay, Harold Landry is on the board, don't screw this up, take Harold Landry. And then sure enough, they still slid down and then ultimately took Rashad Penny over him anyway. But I've had this conversation a couple times, and I'm kind of at a place where if you're sitting at 21 and any of Montez Sweat, Brian Burns, Rashawn Gary, or Jerry Tillery are sitting there, pardon me, that I would take them, because I do think they're blue chip talent, and I think it's extremely important that they add one more blue chip talent up front. But if those names are gone, then I think you do get in a position where it's probably smart to slide back, and I would say slide back quite a bit into the 40s even.
There's been a lot of talk the last couple of days on Seahawks Twitter about how the perceived notion of how they're going to attack and try and address the edge position, maybe more along the lines of Michael Bennett, Malik McDowell, more than the actual out-and-out edge guy. Do you agree with that, with the work you've done? Obviously, the visits, the schools you've seen them be present at?
You know, I'm kind of split on that because I still have very, very high hopes for Rasheen Green. It was a player that I pegged really early on last year as somebody that I thought the Seahawks were going to target because he was wildly inconsistent for USC, but the snaps that it came together for him, you did see that Michael Bennett penetrative skill and, you know, the short area quickness inside. So it's a player that I do still have really high hopes for that could play on the edge on early downs and reduce inside. So I don't know that they necessarily need to target a player that's in that skill set, because, and if Green's young, I think Green is going to head into the season at maybe having just turned 22, so he's far from the finished product. But if a guy like, you know, Jerry Tillery is really appealing to me, he's a controversial name, but Jeffrey Simmons, I think, is someone that you'd have to look long and hard at in round one, just because of the extra year that the fifth-year option affords you. And then a guy like Charles Omenihu is definitely closer to that Malik McDowell, where he gives you the flexibility from outside to in. If I had my choice of it, I would prefer them just to go purely edge. But you can't, you know, with how versatile Pete Carroll's fronts are, I don't think you can go wrong either way.
Is there a chance that they draft with future contract decisions, which may not be made for him in the next couple of weeks, coming up for him? Obviously, Jaron Reed could be someone that could be a victim of the tight cap with Russell Wilson's deal. Obviously, Frank Clark appears likely to be playing on the tag or elsewhere as we currently stand. Just is that a sustainable way to look at a draft, like considering what's coming down the road, or do you just draft on a class by class basis?
I think they almost have the luxury of doing both of those things because they can go for their biggest need, which is still defensive line, kind of almost independent of Jaron Reed and Frank Clark's status is moving forward. But doing so would also give them the luxury of maybe you draft a Jerry Tillery and, you know, you can capture. He had this game against Stanford that if he played like that every single game this year, he would be probably a top five pick. But it was almost like lightning in a bottle. And so maybe they pick him and he captures that form, and then they don't need to worry about paying Reed. So they kind of get to strike that balance.
Was that the he got like 5.5 sacks, didn't he?
Something like that. Yeah, it was essentially it's just become a game of legends on Twitter that there's just this Jerry Tillery Stanford game, and he did. I mean, it's unbelievable. Anybody that can get a chance to watch it, it's one of the most dominant games you'll see from a defensive lineman.
Yeah. So obviously, all the players you've watched at different positions could you just run through each position who someone you'd be hyped about the Seahawks drafting at any point during the draft weekend?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if we want to start a running back, a name that pops out to me big time is Tony Pollard, who, pardon me, he actually played about 80% of his snaps at wide receiver this past year for Memphis, and his teammate Daryl Henderson is kind of getting all the pop. But Pollard, not necessarily a like-for-like player like J.D. McKissic, but close to it, but a much thicker body, a lot more solid. Like, he's about 210 pounds, really explosive, and is just a phenomenal playmaker. And so I'm really obsessed with the idea of them finding somebody who can be that third down back for on a permanent basis. They kind of shoehorn Mike Davis into that role, and I don't think they love McKissic's body type for that role, so I think Pollard would fit it a lot better, which would be great.
So is that like the CJ process, but with actual bones for bones? Is that what?
You'd like to think so, at least, for sure. Definitely a closer body type for him, yeah.
Yeah. Wide receiver?
Wide receiver, I mean, at the very top, he's a really controversial player again, but I love Keem Butler. I love everything about his game. People have him outside of their top 50. Some people have him as a top 10 prospect. The latest thing doesn't sound like he's going to be a first round pick, but I mean, the guy is unbelievable. He's 6'5", 230 pounds, unbelievable change of direction, explosive as hell. He's just physically dominant. And I still just am a believer in kind of trying to chase Sidney Rice's skill set, and Hickey Butler's not exactly like him, but he is, he's that kind of receiver that would just be absolutely physically dominant on the other side and give Wilson a chance pretty much at any point in the time when he needs to throw the ball up.
At tight end, you haven't, as you put in your forward on the document, you haven't put in the two guys from Iowa because you think they'll be long gone by the time the Seahawks pick. firstly, do either of those fit for Seattle? If they do, in fact, fall. But if not, who else at the tight end position do you see the Seahawks possibly looking at? Because obviously it's come out earlier today that the team were in the running for Austin Seferian Jenkins, who's ultimately signed with the Patriots. But first on Fant and Hockenson, is there a fit athletically and schematically for Seattle?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Seahawks' thresholds athletically at tight end are very, very loose. Both of the Iowa tight ends are athletic marvels, so I think they would very much fit into that mold. But and it's actually the same with Irv Smith at Alabama, where it's just a case of I would be shocked if they went tight end at the top. If they went tight end at the top, then maybe you're looking at a Fant or a Smith. I think Hockenson would still be long gone. But they would fit if they decided to go that route. But outside of that, somebody like Jay Sternberger, who they are bringing in for a visit, performed really well in his one season at A&M, and he's more athletic than most of the tight ends they've brought in, and has a really high receiving upside. And I'm really fascinated by Trayvon Wesco, who's West Virginia. He's kind of like an H-back, and I think that they could do some creative things with him in terms of playing him out of the backfield, playing him as an H-back, playing him in line. And, they've kind of, again, shoehorned Luke Wilson to that role one time, and it didn't go great because Luke Wilson's kind of clunky, but Trayvon Wesco is pretty intriguing.
Yeah, there's have you watched any of the Donald Parham from Stetson? He's 6'8". Just seems to be a wide receiver playing in the tight end position for a school I thought was made up until a few weeks ago. Have you seen any of him?
I have just kind of seen clips of him in passing. It seems like every couple of years, or maybe even every year, yeah, a small school tight end who's kind of an athletic marvel grabs attention. I remember Adam Shaheen was kind of the same thing, but those guys seem to almost launch up the draft boards. And again, it's just a tricky one. I just am never convinced that Seattle's going to invest that heavily in tight end.
Yeah. Along the airline, that could be one of the positions, like the defensive line, where they look ahead to contract decisions. Obviously, decisions in terms of age with Dwayne Brown a couple more years down the road. Any names, tackle, or interior guys that you'd like for the Seahawks, or like independently from the work you've done?
I mean, independent of this work and independent of the Seahawks lens, I think whoever drafts Andre Dillard from Washington State is going to get kind of a perennial All-Pro. He was another guy that checked that 4-4 short shuttle box that Josh Norris had written about. I think he's going to go quite high. And then a guy like Titus Howard, I still have a really bad habit of kind of watching offensive linemen through the Tom Cable lens of looking for really, really smooth movers, and Titus Howard's kind of in that mold. But a guy that I watched prior to the Senior Bowl is Chris Lindstrom, who's Boston College's guard. And Boston College ran more than any team in NCAA last year. And he's he's clean prospect, great pedigree, good athletic profile, consistent starter. And he's somebody that it would take kind of a high draft pick. It would probably take their top pick to have to bring him in. But he's someone where you would draft him, and he's probably your left guard for the next 8 to 10 years. So it's an intriguing option. I'm just not sure that it's the best target with their top pick.
Yeah, and then at cornerback, is it Joe Juwan is the one, the most Seahawky one, the one that you would like the most, or is someone else?
I actually don't really think that they're going to target an outside cornerback at all. I think some people are trying to will that into existence, maybe because their confidence is shaken in Shaquille Griffin. I think they're pretty settled in terms of outside corner, at least for the next year or two. So I actually think that they're going to be dropping below that 32-inch arm threshold if they do indeed go after a cornerback and look for a nickelback. And the big name for me is Ugo Amadi from Oregon. Really good change of direction, really good agility testing, and just below 32-inch arms. But you're looking at a guy, he can probably cover tight ends down the seam because he played a little safety at Oregon, and he's somebody that you could probably slide right in. He could be a nickel corner on day one for you.
Yeah, Adam?
No, I'm just staggered by the knowledge, and it's just an incredible piece of work that you've obviously done. For people that are listening that are thinking, I might want to try and get involved in doing draft boards and things like that, what's the first step to take in order to even get close to building such a database as you've done?
I really appreciate the kind words. You guys are very kind.
We're not. We're just nice to first timers. Don't worry.
Okay, perfect. I'll never be back then. I'm going to try to capture this moment. You know, I think it's you almost have to strike a balance. It's really important to kind of not only do the work that you need to do, but show your work. It's something I learned really early on, that you can write about a prospect all you want, but unless you're really showing what you're seeing, then it's kind of hard for somebody to take it with any stock, because they don't really know if you're, what you're saying is accurate. You know, if you're writing about a small school cornerback and you're talking about all these specific traits that he has, you know, the reader doesn't know if it's this event or that. But show your work, and then also you kind of need to look into the background of it. Like, I could have been writing about players last year who never ever would have made sense for Seattle, and I would have been wasting my time. But I'm trying to narrow down the photo, or narrow down the picture, because it just makes it easier on my end, really. So if you can strike the balance between draft philosophy and then the actual work itself, that's once you kind of blend those two things together, then it makes it a lot easier, I think.
Over the draft process, particularly when pro days and that over this couple week window, the phrase top 30 visit is one that's often mentioned by the Schefters and Rappaports of the world. It's two things. What does that mean, entail? And are the Seahawks a team which tip their hand more than others, or is it pretty much all the same kind of tipping of hand league wide with top 30 visits?
Yeah, so I mean, just kind of in terms of what it means, it's just, you know, teams are allowed 30 prospects to visit that are outside of their local area. So, like, you could have a University of Washington prospect come in. That doesn't count as a top 30 visit. But, you know, so they're bringing in, say, Rashawn Gary from Michigan. That's a top 30 visit. And so you're kind of bringing in those players. I don't know whether or not they are more or less kind of tipping their hand than any other team. I remember last year, I think I managed to get 27 of the top 30 visits. And of that, maybe six or seven of the players were players who ended up on Seattle in some capacity. Like, you had a guy like Jacob Pugh, who had a cup of coffee with them in the preseason. And then you had, you know, Puna Ford, who's now a big part of their future, Alex Magoo, who they drafted. But for the most part, like, this year's kind of strange because it's almost at 50%, where 50% of the guys that are supposed to come in aren't guys who fit their profile. And so it could be something as simple as, you know, we want to find out more about your teammate. That's kind of the theory that I'm subscribing to with LJ Collier, who's a TCU edge, who by all accounts is a really impressive prospect, but he's not anywhere near the Seahawks mold of an edge. So I don't think they're interested in that at all. But Ben Banigou, his teammate, who's also a defensive end, he's very much very Seahawky. And I think if you ask me today who I think their first pick will be, that's who I think it is. But so maybe they're just bringing Collier to talk more about Banigou or get intel on him. And so it's just, like you were saying earlier, the draft's one big crapshoot, and I don't think visits are any different.
Yeah, if our first pick is Ben Banigou, I'm going to be tweeting old tweets like other people on Twitter, Adam.
Are you going to retweet yourself as well? That's always a good look.
Yeah, quote tweet and everything. is there anyone that we have mentioned who you like look of that you haven't managed to get all the workout information on? Is there anyone else?
I would just say if they do end up moving back into the 40s or late 30s in the second round, to be on the lookout for Ben Banigou, Max Crosby, and Chase Winovich. They're kind of less heralded edge rushers, but I think they, by all accounts, are getting pushed up some boards, probably because of how top-heavy the edges are. And they're guys who kind of check Seattle's boxes. They check the boxes that are most important, which is short shuttle for the most part. And all three of those players have really good short shuttles. And, you know, every single year it seems like the pick leaves you saying what, among other rude phrases. And those guys kind of check that box as well.
Yeah. So obviously one position you don't have listed on your document, which you've said, because obviously they currently don't really need one past a throwaway pick in the back end of day three, is quarterback position, Adam, which is taking over the headlines somewhat in Seattle Seahawks land, with Russell Wilson's contract being somehow even more annoying than we both expect it to be, Adam.
It's just becoming a bit of a mess, isn't it? Obviously, we've got the deadline coming up apparently on Monday, where talks need to be concluded one way or the other before going into the season with Russell Wilson on his new contract. I don't necessarily think that is actually going to be the case, because there's obviously quite a big lull in June and July when you could also get stuff done. But, moving on to kind of more current Seahawks stuff, Alistair,
what's your initial view on the topic that none of us can avoid, and that would be the Russell Wilson contract situation?
Yeah, despite my best efforts, I can't avoid that topic. I don't think they'll get a deal done by April 15th. If I was John Schneider, I would be doing everything possible to get it done by April 15th, because, you know, a quarterback's contract becomes a bargain basically the second he signs it, because the next one comes in and it's more expensive and it's probably for a less deserving quarterback if your quarterback is Russell Wilson. I still kind of remain in the camp of we're looking at 2 years of franchise tags, because I think they're not necessarily scared but hesitant to commit long-term money before the CBA expires, because I don't know exactly how quarterback contracts are going to shift in the future, but I think they are in for a shift, whether it means percentage of the cap or a certain limit if it's a max contract like the NBA. But I don't think they want to go and sign Russell Wilson to a five-year deal and then be handcuffed by it in 2 years when the CBA comes in and it makes things easier on teams.
Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, as you said, it's cheap. It's a bargain as soon as he signs it, because as garish as these numbers could and probably will be for Russell Wilson, he's going to be outdone by the likes of Dak Prescott and Jared Goff in the next 15 to 18 months, isn't he? Which 15, 18 months down the line, as you say, it looked like a complete bargain, and the Cowboys and Rams are making the terrible, terrible decisions. Do you agree with that, Alistair?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of subscribe to two rules if you think you have a franchise quarterback, or know you do in the case of Seattle, is signing to an extension as early as possible and for as long as possible, because, yeah, it's only going to get cheaper. I mean, I remember when Wilson signed that extension the first time, and they were kind of getting killed, and it's like, okay, well, how much value are they necessarily going to get out of this deal? And, you know, the last 2 years, it's been a tremendously valuable quarterback contract. And so, yeah, I think just get it done as quickly as possible, and you'll be happy to. I just don't know that Seattle is going to do that.
Yeah,
my worry about the situation is that if you franchise tag him for the next 2 years, that's $68 million guaranteed. So basically, the starting point of any deal is going to be that. Now, if it gets to a stage where he says, right, well, I want $40 million for the sake of argument, you know, what do you have a number in your head that is too much? Because I think if the number starts with a four for me, at, you know, average per year, yeah, you can say that Goff and Prescott might get more next year, but, you know, it doesn't really bother me too much. For me, if it gets to a stage where it's that much of a cap killer, I worry that it could end up being kind of a Baltimore Ravens type situation after Flacco, albeit that Flacco never really lived up to his contract. But even if Wilson did live up to that contract, it still probably wouldn't have enough around you to put a team together to go all the way and win it, which is obviously the ultimate goal of all this stuff. So do you guys have a line, or, and if so, where do you draw it? Because I think that's where mine is right now.
I don't think I do, to be honest. I think Russell Wilson's importance to this team is immeasurable. I think wherever he wants, he can kind of get and take, I think, is my kind of stance on it. Because I just think we saw last year with the churn of terrible quarterbacks, it's the reason that Colin Kaepernick won his case, because you just kept seeing the merry-go-round of weird names crop up and start games in the NFL, and just the product for those teams, the play of those teams was so awful. And then you watch to see what's kind of get dragged along the last couple of years by the quarterback, by Russell Wilson. It's kind of an immeasurable value on him, on that, for this team, isn't it, Alistair?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the most terrifying and worst place for any franchise to be kind of in professional sports is quarterback purgatory. And that's exactly where you are again if you get rid of Russell Wilson. You know, there is definitely the risk of it not necessarily providing value, but I think you just kind of almost have to do whatever you can take. When you have a franchise quarterback in the building, you can't let him go.
Adam?
I mean, it's obviously right, but I kind of feel like you end up getting to a merry-go-round whereby the quarterback becomes so overly dominant and overly important in the game that, like, the game itself ends up suffering, because then, as you say, like, Jared Goff is never going to be worth more than Russell Wilson, and, like, the fact that they'll have to give him the deal because, well, that's just the way it goes, it's not really sustainable.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna ask.
Yeah, I would say when it is a quarterback, you know, maybe like Jared Goff, player that, you know, is perhaps the 12th best starting quarterback in the NFL, then maybe there is something to the theory of kind of, okay, let's go back to the draft. Let's try to get another quarterback on a rookie contract and let's roll the dice again. But when it's somebody like Russell Wilson, I think it is just a matter of, you know, pay the price, because he transcends any kind of value you would get from a rookie contract and the players you could bring in around him, because he is just so important. You know, he's maybe one of the five most important players in the NFL, whereas, you know, maybe a Jared Goff is the 26th most important. And then at that time, the cost doesn't necessarily make up for the value. Mm-hmm. But a player like Wilson, I think I'm okay with kind of spending, even if it's $40 million per year and you have to do it, then I'm almost okay with doing it.
Yeah, because I think at 2019, Drew Brees is like 75% of the Saints cap or something ridiculous, and it doesn't seem to be a cause of concern or complaint for the New Orleans fan base. I know Brees is towards the end of it, and it's a longer-term investment with Russell Wilson, but at the same time, I suggest obviously the way the deals broke down with old Thomas, what happened with Richard Sherman last year, then obviously the injury which happened to Cam Chancellor after his big payday, and how they handled and were how the team were handled by Marshall Lynch for his final year in Seattle to get like $12 million to come back. Do you think that would come into consideration with this negotiation, that they're kind of like a bit more reluctant, reticent, a bit more gun shy with what's happened with the Chancellors and Lynches of the world?
I think maybe, if anything, it'll impact a Bobby Wagner extension, somebody like that. I don't know that it'll impact the Russell Wilson extension. I don't know how much stock I necessarily put it into the stories of kind of it was the LOB versus Russell Wilson. The defense hated Russell Wilson, but I do think it's just true across every franchise that the quarterback is just different. They're just a different entity to the rest of the roster, and so I don't think they would kind of shy away from it because of other things, because Russ is just almost different significance to the franchise.
Yeah, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, and it's good that you brought up Bobby Wagner, because I wanted to go on to that next, and Stuart and I had a brief WhatsApp conversation last week where I said, well, you know, if you sign Wilson, I think you probably should be looking to trade Frank Clark and Bobby Wagner this offseason, because I kind of feel that at some point the team has to have a year of suffering. There's been so many things that have gone by the wayside, whether that's by player injury or retirement otherwise, or we've lost players like Sherman and Thomas and the Richardsons and Graham for effectively nothing. For me, there kind of has to be one year where it's going to be a bit shit in order to kind of bounce back. And I my current view is that it should be this year and try and properly go again next year with 10,000 picks and loads of cap room. What do you reckon, Alistair? I mean, maybe I'm just being overly negative and not hopeful enough, and maybe people thought, well, everyone said that last year and they still made the playoffs. But I don't know, it just feels this year is a year that if you were going to take a step back, it should be now.
You know, I am hesitant to say that because I was almost made to look like a fool last year, because I was saying that, where I thought it was a moment in time where it was not necessarily blow it up, but it was pretty close to it, where I was very firmly trade Earl Thomas, because, I mean, I love Earl Thomas deeply, but it was very obvious that they had no plans to extend him, and I didn't think they were in a spot to compete at all. And they kind of surprised everybody. So I think they have almost done an amazing job of not necessarily resetting, but refreshing the roster without dropping out of contention, without dropping out of kind of a relevant NFL team. And I think I don't want to compare it exactly to 2012, but they are almost in that mold where I think they have done that refresher and they're kind of gearing up for, you know, last year was a refreshing season and now we're gearing up and we're expecting to contend again. If they don't hit on their draft picks, then they are going to be in a tough spot, because you need those cheap contributors. Like, they right now, they don't have the pass rush to contend, and they didn't have the space to go out and sign, say, a Ziggy Ansah to a one-year deal. They couldn't make him the Cliff Averill of this version because Russ is getting paid so much. But I think they did a pretty good job of kind of almost avoiding the situation where they need to blow it up to try to start it again, because they've bit by bit been doing so. They just kind of, they need to hit on their early draft picks. They can't be having a guy like Rashad Penny contribute nothing. They can't have a guy not that it was necessarily his fault, but they have a guy like Malik McDowell where you're not getting anything out of him. You need more from Rasheen Green. You need all of these guys to start contributing. Otherwise, you are going to be in a spot where you don't have the cap room to bring in established veterans, and you're not drafting good enough to get contributors. So you're just kind of stuck. Like, you're just going to be a middling franchise at that point.
Is there a date or like a signpost in, along the offseason where if they pass it without a new deal, you think they'll just reconvene at the end of the season, or do you think it'll be an ongoing thing through the games, through the season?
With which player, sorry?
With Wilson, sorry.
Oh, with Wilson? Yeah, I mean, I know he said April 15th. I think it's probably closer to like July 25th or whenever training camp opens. I think at that point, if they don't have anything done, then I definitely think that from Wilson's standpoint, he won't want to continue talking. But yeah, I'm not overly concerned. If they hit April 15th, there's no deal. I don't think it's all of a sudden that he's going to play out the final year of his deal. I think there is still a couple months where you can get something done. But if you don't have something done by training camp, it wouldn't shock me to hear Wilson's side say then they're kind of done negotiating for the year.
Yeah. On the other side of the ball, the market has finally been set. It was set last week with DeMarcus Lawrence signing a 5-year, $105 million contract with the Dallas Cowboys. It includes $25 million signing bonus and $65 million guaranteed. That seemed to almost be a white smoke for Frank Clark's future in Seattle, which to his complete, I mean, he seemed to completely ignore it with his Twitter interactions over the weekend, but that kind of puts a nail in his future in Seattle, doesn't it? Because they're not paying Frank Clark that much, are they?
I don't think so, no. I'm a little fearful of how they're going to play it, because they're not going to do something just, you know, to protect their investment. We just saw it with Earl Thomas. They're not going to kind of sign up for something if they're not completely invested, and you know, maybe they're going to make the right choice by not giving Frank Clark $21 million per year. He's not on the level of DeMarcus Lawrence. Like, I think DeMarcus Lawrence is probably the second best 4-3 defensive end in the NFL. Frank Clark probably falls kind of somewhere towards fifth. But yeah, I have a really hard time. They've never, you know, even when they signed Earl Thomas and Sherman to those extensions, it was still a pretty competitive rate, but it wasn't like a blowing out of the water. And I just have a hard time seeing them paying that to Clark. It would honestly astonish me at this point. And I am not totally sure how they're going to play it, but I really don't expect them to sign him to an extension.
Adam?
I think you've absolutely nailed it there, Alistair. Like, there needs to be... I just couldn't believe when the Lawrence deal was announced that all of a sudden, like, the narrative across social media was, well, that's the market for Frank Clark, so he'll now want more than Lawrence, to kind of like completely ignore the fact that for me Lawrence is a different league of player to Frank Clark, albeit Frank did have a really good season last year, but we've seen it once and I'm not necessarily convinced that he could ever do better than that. So I found it astonishing. You know, he can do all the dancing man emojis that he wants, but for me Tank Lawrence getting 65 means that he should get less than 65, and unless he's willing to accept that, I don't really think there's even a sniff that the Seahawks should be going after that, because I just don't think it's money well spent. With a rookie quarterback, I wouldn't even necessarily say that's the best use of your money, let alone with a guy that's going to want $40 million a year, which is effectively you're kind of giving two guys three times quarterback money. It's just not sustainable.
No, I don't really understand how the Cowboys are for it, but I don't see any way that Frank Clark is getting that from Seattle. It's probable as well. You won't get that from many other places, if anywhere around the league, will they, Alistair?
No, I mean, I think it would have to be a team where they are in, you know, they have a rookie contract and they have, you know, more cap space than they know what to do with. Like, I keep getting drawn back to Oakland. And if there's some way that you could provide the 27th pick from them for Frank Clark, then I think you got to be all over it. But yeah, it's just like the idea of paying him $21 million per year, it really startles me, because there's just, you're not really getting value on that contract. Would I rather, you know, if you say you get the 27th pick for Frank Clark, and then you're looking at, okay, you can bring in an edge rusher who's on a rookie deal in that first round pick, and, you know, ideally he kind of gets towards the level that Clark is at, And then you have that $21 million. You can also give, say, Ziggy Ansah, a player of his level, $12 million deal, like a prove-it deal. And you can sign a guy like a Brandon Graham, who is a really, really solid rusher, for like $7 million. And you're spending around $21 million, but you're getting more talent and more depth. And like, this is a league that's kind of thriving on rotation on the defensive line. And to give that much, you know, maybe next year you're looking at $35 million to Jerran Reed and Frank Clark combined. Like, that's not – I don't think that's a way to win, really.
No, and obviously there's the thing on the ground in terms of quotes and comments, but the comments they are making, particularly John Schneider, do you see any hints of how they're going to approach it, or do you just think it's just a wait and see and just hope that they kind of see it along the majority's – how the majority of people see it with Clark especially?
Yeah, I think they seem to just be playing it coy, so I think it's anybody's best guess which direction it goes. I mean, Pete was pretty firm at the combine that Frank's going to be a part of the team moving forward, but I don't know, the lack of really anything coming out of either side is kind of interesting right now.
Yeah, it's I'm looking at Lawrence's contract. It is insane. I mean, is Ziggy Ansah still a free agent?
Yeah, there's I think he's expected to sign kind of the next week or two, but I can't remember what exactly it was. He had to have a surgery that kind of cleaned something up, and so they're holding off on it. But I mean, he just had terrible timing in terms of, like, he hit free agency after an amazing season, got franchise tagged, and then was hurt, and now he has to hit free agency again. And so he's in a tough spot, but I would happily give him $10-12 million on a one-year deal and let him try to reset his value.
Talking, anything else, Adam?
Well, yeah, I mean, as reductive as this sounds, I am looking at pretty much any deal the Seahawks do from now on with the mindset of, would the Patriots do this? Because I think they've built up more than enough credit in the bank to suggest that everything they even think about doing is correct. And I just don't think there's any hope in hell that they would give Frank Clark a long-term deal. And I think they would look at it and say, if we can turn a third-round pick after 3 or 4 years of good play into a first round pick with 5 years on a rookie contract, that's absolutely what we should do. And yeah, I know it's maybe overly simplistic, but that if they can do that, as you say, if they can get the 27th pick for Frank Clark, you've almost saved your entire draft. And I think that would absolutely be the way to go.
And also Patriots have literally just done that with Trey Flowers.
Exactly.
Literally exactly what they did. They got 1 year of production out of him, and now they're going to get a third round pick for the amount of money Detroit threw at him, Alistair.
Yeah, and I mean, it's pretty much, you look at a team like, it's the Patriots, it's the Eagles, those teams are kind of the gold standard right now, and yeah, you nailed it. I don't think either of them are giving Clark that contract. Like you said, you know, Trey Flowers was kind of, Robert Mays for The Ringer wrote this amazing piece about how Trey Flowers was kind of the ideal Patriots defensive lineman, because he just, you know, it's a very Patriots thing, but he just did his job. He went quietly about it. He was versatile. He did whatever was asked of him, and he never made a peep, and he got paid. He didn't get paid by the Patriots because they knew, you know, there's this kind of a ceiling to it. You can retain your players, but to a point you have to worry about, like, we're just not getting value back on this contract, and it's just not something the Patriots would do. So, like you said, they got a third-round comp pick, and then what do? They turn around and send a day-three pick to Michael Bennett, who can pretty much replicate Trey Flowers' production. And like you said, there's, like, it's almost a market inefficiency of trading late picks for veterans, and the good teams are seeming to do it right now. And yeah, rather than paying $22 million per year to Frank Clark, I think that's kind of a market that I would love to see Seattle exploit.
Yeah, and it's like the checkers chess thing, isn't it, with Belichick and the Patriots? As Adam said, it crops up with alarming regularity, doesn't it, Adam?
Well, the picks thing is really interesting, and it's funny you mentioned the Eagles, because I think the Jordan Howard trade for a sixth-round pick is just absolutely brilliant from them, and I'm amazed and impressed they managed to get him for so cheap. Now, I know he is a bit of a tell in the sense that he's not great in the passing game, so if he's on the field, it's going to be a run. But, Alistair, what do you reckon about the idea that, you know, a lot of these teams are now thinking, do you know what, this sixth-round pick might be better off used on a veteran that we know we can get something out of, versus ultimately a bit of a hedge, which any sixth-round pick is going to be?
Yeah, I just think, like, I mean, I love the draft almost as much as anything in the NFL calendar, but the way the teams value day three picks is just ridiculous. Like, the idea that you're going to get a contributor that can give you more than Michael Bennett can on for a fifth round pick is insane to me. So it is definitely a thing where, if you can turn around, okay, sure, you can get a special teams contributor on $600K with that fifth round pick, or you can turn around and trade it for a guy who's going to legitimately help your defensive line rotation, and you're going to give him $6 million. Like, that's a massive, massive difference value. And it's yeah, like you're saying, it's chess and checkers, and you know, the Patriots and Eagles and great franchises like that are kind of doing that, whereas Seattle seems to have fallen by the wayside of innovation.
Yeah. Also another headline maker, somewhat more subliminally, is Doug Baldwin in his not just long-term but short-term future as an NFL player, as obviously as a Seahawks player. Mike Groffalo of NFL Network tweeted out the news that N'Keal Harry from Arizona State, wide receiver, is pretty highly regarded leading into the draft, was visiting the Seahawks, and he put in, which is waiting to see what Doug Baldwin decides in his future, and it kind of set everyone off and alarm bells ringing. Doug Baldwin, do you think he's finished, Alistair?
You know, I wasn't sure how much stock to put into this, but I had kind of heard as early as February that people inside the facility and Baldwin himself weren't totally sure what was going to happen for 2019 and beyond. And I didn't really put much stock into it just because I think he's due $13 million this year. And then he's probably going to get cut next year, kind of independent of his health. And so it just made sense for me to, you know, it would make sense for him to tough out one more year and collect a really, really big check. And then he can kind of go. But yeah, after that Garofalo tweet, I kind of shifted my view to, I don't think that he'll be back. Maybe he sees how his body responds in June, July, a month or so out from that sports hernia surgery. But I think Seattle needs to plan as though Baldwin won't be a part of the team moving forward.
Adam, Harry Kane's ankle, Doug Baldwin's legs, is kind of not a great few days in regards to that, is it, Adam?
I know. I mean, I'd happily donate my body parts, which are at least average, you'd have to say, and fairly untarnished to them if I possibly could. I think the problem with Baldwin at the moment is that I'm not necessarily convinced he had that much fun playing last year. And no. For a guy that I think loves the game passionately, but I think there needs to be something that the game gives him at the same time. And I think having the opportunity to play with his best mate in Richard Sherman was something that was a massive motivator. He was always a kind of guy that I felt was kind of he was wired like one of the defensive guys more than an offensive guy, despite being an offensive leader in my eyes. And I just wonder if he's having that much fun anymore. And he might think that, yeah, the money's good, but I can probably go and earn that money doing something else that I could have a bit more fun doing. Because, I mean, let's face it, the guy's absolutely brilliant. Brilliant mind, and I'm sure he's going to be a success in whatever he does going forward. And yeah, I just think maybe he's just not having as much fun anymore, and that might be the thing that partnered with the injuries makes him think, nah, don't fancy this anymore.
Yeah, that kind of seemed to be the thing with Calvin Johnson, obviously a different species almost to Doug Baldwin in terms of wide receiver, but he kind of all of a sudden kind of went, nah, I've had my fill, didn't he? And it kind of seems that Doug Baldwin, Alistair, could be going down the same road as Megatron did.
Yeah, I mean, I would say for starters, if we're going to have anybody donate body parts, let's make it Musa Sissoko, because he's not doing anything useful with them anyway.
You take that back immediately. I forgot you're a Liverpool never will. Fan. You're a Liverpool fan.
I'm a Newcastle fan, actually. So I was happy to see the back of Sissoko, but just utterly useless.
Player of the year for 2018-19 Champions League winners, Alistair, so you might have to take that back.
Player of the year when he feels like it, which is maybe once every couple months. But I do agree, though. Baldwin is definitely one of those players that's kind of, he's more than football. He doesn't need football. And if it's too hard on his body, then I don't think he's going to stick around just because it's like his identity. I think he's going to accomplish a hell of a lot more in kind of the next chapter of his life than he is during these 9-10 years on a football field. So if it is taking that big of a toll on his body, then I think we can kind of expect him to move on. And, you know, it's selfishly it would suck, but I'd be happy for the guy because I think he's going to do some great things in the future.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I think myself and Adam said a few times, in regards to Baldwin in particular, he's kind of one of those players which you're somewhat weirdly proud of being the player on your team, isn't he, Alistair?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, kind of towards the end here with Earl Thomas and everything, my friend and I have kind of just been going over, like, what are the legacies of all these players? And I just keep going back to, like, Doug Baldwin is kind of the heartbeat of the entire thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you see all these players leaving and, you know, maybe a bit of a heel turn on the way out, like a Richard Sherman or like an Earl Thomas. Not that I begrudge either of them for the way they left, but, like, Doug Baldwin almost just seemed to step into a whole different role, you know, from going to, like, I'm not totally sure if him and Russell Wilson like one another, to all of a sudden it's like, we maybe don't have an identity as a football team, but Doug Baldwin is giving us an identity, he's giving us a voice, and he's kind of making sure that we don't lose what made us great previously, using the royal we there. But yeah, it's he's just a player that just so much joy watching, whether it's kind of separating the top of his route, fighting for another yard, or just, like, holding Russell Wilson accountable, screaming his face on the sideline. You just get, like, such a jolt of energy watching the guy play.
He's not a guy that I can face seeing his career finishing by him going off on a stretcher. We're all kind of grown men. You don't get kind of overly emotional about this stuff, but that would honestly, it would crush me to see him going off in a car and that would be the end of it. It would just be horrible.
Yeah, if he did walk away this year, it kind of just fit in with how he's handled and done everything over his NFL career. Again, doesn't it? If he just walked away, if he called the shots and how he walked away and left the Seahawks, it kind of would fit in with everything else he's done and how he's represented and presented himself over his NFL career, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's a perfect way to walk away. I mean, he battled through such a trying 2018. He came up big in the biggest moment in that win over Kansas City, and, you know, his only 100-yard game. And then, you know, if that's it, we just saw that he still had a little bit left, but it was kind of becoming too much on his body, and he walked away. Then, you know, all power to him.
Yeah, so obviously we'll wait and see what happens with that. I think the June, July, when camp kicks back up, it does kind of feel like a good time. But with that, if that is the time, how do you see the team addressing the position, with that probably being still something which will be undecided in a couple of weeks when the draft rolls round, Alistair?
You know, I think independent of Baldwin's status for 2019, Jermaine Curse's return is almost inevitable. I think it's just happening. Whether it's in 2 months or in 2 weeks or in 2 days, I think it's just kind of happening, and I'm just waiting for it to appear already.
Yeah, that does seem to be inevitable. Obviously, before the draft, though, we'll obviously keep an eye on all the names mentioned and hope that Doug Baldwin and Russell Wilson's futures are decided. But as ever, Adam, should we dive back into the bin?
Yes, indeed.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and Mike, and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Yeah, so time for another Get in the Bin. Alistair, to quickly explain what this is, every week on the podcast we put in one person, one brand, one team, or one situation, which we've had enough of hearing and kind of is a bit dumb and silly, as you can imagine. Le'Veon Bell, Colin Cowherd, Hugh Jackson is a massive part. He's if there was an award for this, he would be... His name and face would be all over it, wouldn't it, Adam?
Yeah, anything that you're just done hearing about in the NFL this week, you're allowed to put in the trash can, and that's it. So have a think. Stu will lead off. I'll go after that, and then we're expecting big things from you for your your debut bin performance.
Perfect.
Adam, I think I'm going to go to you while I have a bit of a think. Anyone for you this week to throw in the bin?
Yeah, I mean, it is a long off season, and the amount of coverage, I don't know how many more times I can go onto Twitter and see a video of a split screen of Andrew Siciliano looking very confused, and Rappaport and Garofolo and then Charlie Casserly. And there's just so much shit spoken every day about nothing. And my new one is that the only way you can possibly evaluate how much a player wants it is like, is he the first man in the building in the morning? And like, I think Charlie Casserly was the one that did it for me with Josh Rosen when he's like, you find out what time the janitor gets there and you get there before him. I mean, that is just so fucking stupid. Like, it's 2019. The world is so different. Cliff Kingsbury is talking already about how every 20 minutes he's going to give his team a, you know, cell phone breaks during meetings, which is entirely sensible, to be honest.
And also, everyone lost their collective minds about him doing that as well.
Of course, because, you know, we must be in meetings for 18 hours a day and then practice for the other 9 hours of the day and then have negative 3 hours sleep because sleeping is the enemy. And it's just, there's just so much nonsense now. And the off-season's long and it's now, I actually think they should just turn off things at NFL Network for 2 or 3 months a year and just give everyone peace. But if I have to hear about how someone's determination and desire can be measured by his willingness to be the first person to turn the alarm code off at the facility, I think that's done. So for me, that can get right in the bin.
Yeah, I think I saw you have a conversation with someone about that a couple of days ago as well. So for me, I think there's it's often how thing where if you give someone enough oxygen, eventually they'll throttle themselves or make themselves look severely stupid and kind of own themselves. I think Antonio Brown did that a couple of days ago when he posted an Instagram message he got a few years ago from Juju Smith-Schuster, where Juju was just asking for some tips and help, and Brown presented it as him. I'm not even sure what Brown was trying to get there, but Antonio Brown has kind of, he's got his way. Now it's time, in the Charlie Casserly way, he's kind of just shutting up for a few months and getting to work with your subpar quarterback. So quickly, Antonio Brown can return to the proverbial bin. Alistair, anyone for you or anything?
Yeah, I would just, the big one for me, and it's something that I have been slamming the table about for the past few months here, is the idea that Shaquille Griffin all of a sudden needs to be replaced, or that all of a sudden Trey Flowers is a better prospect than Shaquille Griffin. Shaquille Griffin was a third round pick who came and he started 15 games and he looked great. He learned a brand new technique and he played terrifically. And then they drafted Trey Flowers and he got shifted to a new side, which is essentially playing a new position. And yeah, he struggled. He already struggled with finding the football, and all of a sudden all of the mechanics were reversed. And it doesn't mean that he's all of a sudden a lost prospect. He's still incredibly athletic. He's everything that Pete Carroll wants in a cornerback. And he's entering his third year. He could still be an all-pro. People are trying to write off his career already, and it's absolutely ridiculous. The Seahawks don't need to draft an outside cornerback because Griffin struggled in his second year in the NFL. So I want that idea to go in the bin.
But yeah. Alistair, the problem is, if you don't announce well in advance that someone is a bust, if they one day turn into a bust, where would you possibly find your tweets where you called this as such a visionary going forward? You know, surely everything's about leverage these days, and that's where it's all gone completely wrong with someone like Griffin, who is obviously easily good enough to play for this team.
Yeah, I just want to be first. I don't care if I'm right.
Absolutely, that's much more important, is to be first these days. That's all that matters.
Yeah, perfect. Talking to Shaquille, I've said a few podcasts. Webb Staton, who we have on from Seahawks Draft Blog, which is also a really invaluable draft resource as well. He sort of seemed to agree with me about the questions over the Seahawk future of Shaquille's twin brother, Shaquem. How do you see his Seahawk stock being as we move into the 2019 season, Alistair?
I think it's almost gone like a bit of an overcorrection this offseason, where everybody was so excited that he got drafted and so in love with the story last year that people kind of thought, oh, it's okay, KJ Wright's injured, like Shaquem Griffin, now he's just going to step into the lineup and he's going to be a 16-game starter. The reality was, when they drafted him, is that he was a highly athletic fifth-round linebacker who, you know, his ceiling is probably just being a really, really good special teamer for the rest of his career, and that's okay because he was a fifth-round pick, and I think that his ceiling remains unchanged. But this offseason, people have changed where it's sunk cost and he should be cut, but he's still like athletic, he's quick, he's clearly a really, really good person, and I think if he can give you 8 years of really good stress of special teams play, then that's an absolute hit in the fifth round, and that's kind of, I think that's where he should be measured at.
So what you're saying is, somewhat shockingly, Seahawks Twitter overreacted.
They may have, just for the first time.
Adam?
Yeah, I do love it when they're starting to call, like, who's going to get cut already. I mean, I think I can name about
14 players that are currently Seahawks. Like, I'm not even sure we have enough to put an entire offense on the field anymore. Like, there's so few players. So maybe let's get to 90 and then start whittling down, see what we want. Because at the minute, I think you and I and Alistair, we might be like at least in the second batch of cuts, given how many players they need to pick up over the offseason, like just to put a roster, just to put like a camp together. So yeah. I think, yeah, in the same way as not always being first is the most important thing. Maybe we can calm down on anything, because at this stage, like, yeah, camp, yeah. Camp's going to be like a five-a-side tournament as opposed to an 11-a-side game at the moment.
Yeah, so obviously another thing which has happened in the last time since we podcasted is the rise and equally fast fall of the, was it the AAFL? Is that right? Was that what it's called?
AAF, I think.
AAF. That's just kind of another, that's a rogue owner going rogue, isn't it, Adam?
I don't really know enough about it, like, to say too much, but it just seems like there is the NFL are in the position where they're desperate to have a feeder league, but then they don't want to have to do anything to risk their own product for this feeder league to happen. So yeah. In the same way, like, maybe the XFL will work because it's a completely separate entity, but the money that it takes to put one of these things together is just, for me, that's what's going to be prohibitive about the whole thing. And they're almost going to be better off having kind of reserve team equivalents, like the Seahawks reserves. Not that we can even have put a first team out together, as we've just said. Maybe that's the way to do it, but it just seems like another classic example of the NFL wanting to have its cake and eat it, and then kind of it all going to pot as a result.
Yeah, as someone who's just sat through and witnessed Vince McMahon managed to keep people interested in wrestling for an entire weekend whilst in New York City, that man, if he has the money in the backing and the chance, he could pretty much do anything. And learning from his mistakes the first time around with the XFL, that's got a chance, because Vince McMahon is just, he's like very few other human beings who have existed. Did you pay much attention to the AFL, whatever it was called, Alistair?
No, I can't say I did. I was more interested in it from a standpoint of, you know, will a second league work this time around? But I didn't really watch the football itself. I kind of was ready for a little bit of a break from football there before draft season kind of picked back up, so I didn't let myself get invested, and I think I made the right choice, apparently.
Yeah, I think so. It was 8 weeks it lasted, and now like 30 players have been signed to different NFL teams. As you say, Adam, it's just a case of getting to 90 instead of actually these players are going to be Sunday night contributors, isn't it?
Yeah, it's such a shame that they aren't able to make something happen, because I guess there is it sounded like the ratings were much better than, you know, other NFL network programs. And from what I could glean, the ratings were as good as kind of decent golf tournaments and tennis, masters events. So there obviously is an appetite for this. And, you know, what else are you going to do on the weekend? You know, if the game's on, you're going to stick it on. It's better than watching baseball, for all intents and purposes. Maybe you don't agree, but I can't get my head around that one. It just seems like a shame that I can't imagine that it's ever going to be an itch that's going to be able to get scratched, because there's just too much, too many details surrounding it that will prohibit it.
Yeah, but talking of baseball, watching Mariners Twitter try not to get carried away with the start that team has made is quite entertaining, because you can just see them trying to, like, chomping at the bit to just lose their collective minds at how this team is just bashing that ball to all corners. I think that's everything, Adam.
I think we've chopped it all up. We've settled all hash, yeah. And we've done well.
So, Alistair, if people want to check out your, as I'm saying, extensive and pretty remarkable work you've done on the 2019 NFL draft, where can they find that, and then obviously follow along with all your opinions and takes and write field goal articles on social media, Alistair?
Yeah, they can follow me on Twitter at @ByAlistairCorp. Seahawks draft board's pinned to the very top, so you can just find it there anytime you want to take a look at it. It's kind of a living document, so if it is something that people like, definitely recommend kind of bookmarking it, because it's something I update, you know, not on a daily basis now that the pro days are done, but I just continue to try to follow along and add to it and make the picture a little bit more clear. And then, yeah, just fieldgoals.com. That's where I'm writing and can find some great work there. But thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, no, we massively appreciate it. And as we both said, it is a really cool and really has helped hone in and look at players differently, especially for me. I think Adam kind of agrees with me as well, Adam.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so if you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can on all usual means. The Pedestrian Podcast at podbean.com. On Facebook, we are UK Seattle Seahawks fans, and also podcast page, The Pedestrian Podcast. On Twitter, it's at Seahawkers UK, and also the personal ones are never listened to, so I won't mention them. The national meet, the fourth or fifth annual national meet, is just now a month away up in Newcastle upon Tyne on the 18th of May. FA Cup final day as Man City play. Are they playing, Adam? Watford?
Watford, yeah.
Watford.
Yeah, so I'm not too sure there'll be many fans of that who will be at Newcastle. If they're out, then come and join the kicking off from, I'm not too sure. But if you want to come, you can. Ticket prices are up to you, and you just turn up on the day and throw in whatever you want to towards our chapter charities, which are SSAFA, Archie's Smile and Helinski's Hope. There's loads of items being donated for raffles and auctions, including a signed ball, which was signed at the last edition of the Marcus Trufant bowling night. So there's like Sir Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor and Marcus Trufant himself all signed it, as well as the VIP ticket pass and all the details, everything that allowed the best to ever do it, Walter Jones, to get into Wembley Stadium back in October, which he has also signed and donated unprompted after the game, didn't he, Adam?
We watched him sign it in Wingman's restaurant in Kilburn, I believe.
Yeah,
so it definitely his signature, because I watched him do it.
Yeah, so obviously, again, massive thanks to Alistair for joining us. Until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks.
Okay, and last one for you. Do you ever envision a time, potentially, where you sign a one-dayer, maybe, with Seattle and retire a Seahawk Earl? I know, again, there's so much football left. You haven't even played a down for the Ravens yet. Is that something you'd even think about?
Yeah, I envision myself retiring as a Seahawk. I would never burn a bridge there. You know, I still love my teammates. I definitely see myself signing maybe a one-day deal, and hopefully they'll hang my jersey in the Raptors.